Gebet daher schlurre. Yes, good evening and welcome everybody. I'm Tom Gillesberg, chairman of the Copenhagen EIR office here in Copenhagen, and also president of the Schiller Institute in Denmark. And just to let you know, I mean, we have been doing these seminars now not on a regular schedule, but from time to time, to have a diplomatic seminar in order to give the diplomatic community a chance of discussing the real issues of history taking place right now, instead of just all the practical stuff that embassies normally are overloaded with, and which has to be taken care of, but which does not really satisfy a human mind fully. And the way we do this is that I will give an introduction, a presentation, and we will record that just for others that are not able to be here to be able to view it later. And then after that, we'll turn off the recording so we can have a free and frank and open discussion without having to worry about who might be listening in. So, just to introduce it, I hope most of you are by now familiar with our international journal, the Executive Intelligence Review. For 37 years now, this has been a journal of the record given out in the United States, founded by the American economist and politician Lyndon LaRouche, and has been one of the very, very few windows where you actually can join the discussion of the deeper issues taking place behind the scenes in the United States, but also on a world scale. This is nowadays mostly available as an electronic copy that you can subscribe to, that you can get. Also for those who are not, does not for one reason or another have a subscription on the net, a lot of the articles, especially key articles by Lyndon LaRouche, is made accessible. And as I said, this is not the best picture, we get a better. This is Lyndon LaRouche, who founded the magazine and who does deserve somewhat of an introduction. He's the founder of EIR and the Schiller Institute, our international campaign. But he has also, for more than five decades, been the most precise and actually the only precise forecaster of key economic developments on the world scale. And just to let you know, on Saturday he actually gave a webcast from Washington, which can be viewed on the internet, where he gives the latest strategic input. He has not only been forecasting the economic development, but he has also, since he's a very committed and passionate human being, committed to the well-being of the world presently and in the coming generations, he has also, over the last 5 decades, therefore, made a huge number of proposals of how actually to deal with the economic crisis and dilemmas we have been faced with, but also been a very key player in trying to develop a changed global strategic setting and prevent what has unfortunately been a very nasty game that has been played for many centuries and many millennia now, of certain forces trying to control the world through divide et impera, through to divide and conquer, to divide and rule. Formerly this was done by the Persian Empire, by many empires, by the Roman Empire. In the last couple of centuries, the center of this kind of very nasty policy has been the British Empire. And Mr. LaRouche has been again and again been warning about how mankind and how nations are led to their own destruction, to their destruction by their own hands, by them letting themselves being manipulated into these games of pitting one against each other, creating wars, chaos, creating conflict. And as I will go through today, this is not a thing of the past. I mean, right now we have a very, very real issue on the agenda of certain forces in London trying to get Israel engaged in an attack on Iraq, which would then mean a counterattack from Iran, of course. Iraq is already attacked. Get a counterstrike from Iran against Israel, and then use that as the launching pad of getting what cannot be gotten right now, of getting the United States and other parts of the world to engage in the destruction of Iran. This is not the only case, but this is a game that is ongoing, and Mr. LaRouche has been the key person in trying to upset this game and instead get some true solutions for mankind. I'll just reference one thing here, which was in the beginning of the 80s, Mr. LaRouche became a key player on many different issues. I took this picture, a later picture of López Portillo from Mexico, together with LaRouche's wife, Helga Sepp LaRouche. This was taken at a later point. But in 1982, there was a very direct operation taking place where López Portillo asked Lyndon LaRouche in the big debt crisis of 1982, how are we going to survive in Mexico and in South America? We have this enormous debt. We cannot pay it. The banks simply want us to commit suicide in order to pay the banks. Is there not another way? And at the time, LaRouche then wrote for Mexico and South America and the world in general a document called Operation Juarez, which was a document basically going through a series of measures that Mexico and South America could take, going in, stopping the flight capital that was leaving South America at the time, being deposited in the United States, other places, going in with control of the banks, taking control of the banks, nationalizing them effectively, taking control of the financial transaction, and then create credit for massive economic reconstruction and salvation of the national economies. And at the time, LaRouche says, if one country does this alone, that country will be smashed by the international financial forces. But if a series of South American countries, Ibero-American countries, go together on doing this, then they have the economic debt of a size which will mean if they don't pay it, the world financial system goes broke. All the debtors, all the ones that have given the loans, will go broke, and therefore you can reorganize, you can renegotiate a deal for where the debt can be reorganized for long-term credits over 30 years, very low interest rates, and you can add in new credits for development of the economies to make the economies able to be developed so they can pay this over the long term. Lobos Portillo said, yes, we're going to do this. He presented this also in the United Nations. Unfortunately, the other nations of Ibero-America thought they could get a better deal by doing it alone, negotiating with Henry Kissinger and others. And when Lobos Portillo shortly after was replaced with a new president, the whole thing ended. And if you look at South and Central America today and see how devastated they have been over the last 25 years, then you get an idea of the stupidity of not taking the fight when they could. Now, of course, I'm also saying this because this was South and Central America in 1982. This is a lot of European countries in 2010. Standing at the same crucial decisions right now. The other thing that Mr. LaRouche was very key-played in, this is also, I had to very quickly put these together. This is not the best picture you can get a big. This is Lyndon LaRouche sitting talking with Ronald Reagan in the election campaign in 1980, where they were out on the campaign trail, and where Mr. LaRouche took place for the second time in the presidential election. He has since been running many, many times, not the last couple of times, but also I think seven times he has been running for presidential election. And this is a very important event because the discussions that started here in 1980 in the elections led to a collaboration between LaRouche and the Reagan administration. A collaboration which led to a very historic event on March 23rd, 1983, when Ronald Reagan went on national television in the United States and launched what became the Strategic Defense Initiative, a program where the United States said, we are committed to developing defensive systems which can destroy incoming nuclear missiles, but this is not just something we want for ourselves. We extend an invitation to the Soviet Union to join us in this collaboration. So the United States and the Soviet Union, the two big enemies, jointly develop effective means to destroy nuclear weapons and thereby destroy the terror balance. And if you do that, it also opens, of course, the door up for, since the main adversaries collaborate on the highest scientific level, then this whole thing of having what you can call technological apartheid, that you cannot share technology because then your enemy might get hold of it, that would then be ended and the world would be opened up to access all over the world to the highest level of technology developed. Reagan went with this program, unfortunately, and LaRouche discusses this in his webcast last Saturday. I would recommend you go back and get the full story. Unfortunately, the Soviet Union said, no thanks, we don't want collaboration, we'll do it on our own. And this is what led to the demise of the Soviet Union 5 years later. Actually, LaRouche was in negotiations on behalf of the Reagan administration with the Soviet Union at the time, and in the negotiations directly said, if you don't agree to this, if you want to try to develop this on your own, it will take another of your planning cycles, 5 years, then the Soviet Union will be bankrupt. And 6 years later, the Soviet Union, the wall came down, and what was the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact and this whole thing was no more. LaRouche has also been the key opposition to this process of globalization that has been going on for the last 40 years now, on the basically from the standpoint that the idea of dissolving national sovereignty, doing away with the nation states, where you can have representative democracies, and replacing that by letting the market control things, that is the private financial interests, is a very rotten deal. Because the whole idea with sovereign nation states is that they are the commitment not only to secure the general welfare of the present generations, but also the general welfare of the coming generations. Private financial interests in the marketplace have no such commitment. They have only the commitment to secure power and wealth for themselves, and they are very, very limited circle. So, on this standpoint, LaRouche has been leading the fight on getting the United States back to its roots in the revolution it made against the British Empire to become a sovereign state, and re-establishing a world order of a collaboration between sovereign nation states for the benefit of the general welfare, for the benefit of the people. And if you look back a little bit on history, then you immediately come to when was this really present in political power in the United States. It was a little bit under John F. Kennedy, but if you really want the full package, then you go back to Franklin D. Roosevelt, who at the crucial time when all of Europe, out of the economic crisis, turned to fascism and turned to military dictatorships and turned to doing away with democracy and government by the people. In the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt solved the crisis in a totally different way. He went in with a attack on speculation, attack on the looting by the banks. He went directly to war with Wall Street. And out of the war with Wall Street came a series of measures, like a Glass-Steagall policy of sanitizing the banks, outlawing speculation, and then creating credit for national economic development in the United States. Massive job creation through investments in infrastructure, through investments in things like Tennessee Valley Authority, electrification, science, development. And the United States came, under the leadership of FDR, came from being a broken nation to become, again, the world leader. And actually, through this economic recovery under Roosevelt, actually also led the fight to liberate the war out of fascism in World War II. So LaRouche says this has to be repeated. This is the policy that has to be revived today, and it can only be done on a serious level right now if the United States takes part of that. Recently then, for the present crisis, LaRouche, this is a picture from one of the webcasts he's been giving regularly. This was from July 27, 2007, where he directly at the time warned, we are days away from a new financial breakdown crisis, from a dissolution of the global financial system as we've known it, and now we have to take measures to deal with that. 3 days later, the crisis began, which later got to be named the subprime crisis and all of these funny names that were given to it, but which is not a subprime crisis, which is not a bank crisis, which is really a crisis of the whole global financial system falling apart. An exposure that all of the values that has been on the books of the present financial system, most of them are fraudulent and are simply not there. The system is bankrupt. And at the same time, LaRouche therefore says there is an alternative to this, what we have just been named the LaRouche Plan. A plan for of not responding to the the breakdown crisis and the economic crisis and the financial crisis by austerity policies, by saying now the people have to pay the price for this going wrong. No. And the alternative to that, in the spirit of FDR, is to say we'll save the people, not the speculators. We'll bail out the population, but not the rotten banks. Like Roosevelt did. And then create credit for massive infrastructure development. This is a picture from June 16, 1933, where you have Roosevelt signing into law something called the Glass-Steagall legislation, and Glass and Steagall are standing on his side. Basically sanitizing the banking system, saying we go through every single bank and divide it up. We look at it, what is normally banking activities, lending out to companies for investments, credit for people buying houses, normal economic activities in the economy. All of that we save. All of the other stuff they do on Wall Street, earning money on money, making funny things. Today it's called derivatives, credit default swaps, all of these scams that have been developed. All that we don't save. And we even make a law which says that normal banks, which are chartered by the state, by the United States, can only have government support if they do not engage themselves in all of this funny stuff. Only normal banking activities for the normal economy. And then you can then make investment banks and all of these dirty things. But that will be under sharp regulation, and it will definitely not be supported by the government. Then you create national credit for development. You create through a national bank. Roosevelt did not do it through a national bank, but he did do it through the state. Create credit for big infrastructure projects, for job creation, for the development of the whole economy, infrastructure programs for science. This is, for instance, it's of course railroads, roads, electricity. This is then water projects, getting down water to the United States and Mexico. Big infrastructure projects of a duration of 30 to 50 years, sometimes even 100 years. The kind of investments that only the state can really make, because private financial interests do not think 30 or 50 years ahead. If they think 30 or 50 days ahead, then they are considered to be long-term investments. At the same time, LaRouche has said massive development of nuclear power, not only for the United States, but let the United States become revive its scientific capacity and begin a massive export of nuclear technologies to all the different nations of the world that might be interested in it. That this idea of technological apartheid, of first-class and second-class nations, some nations not being allowed to have the most modern technology, that this has to end, and that this is also what can revive the United States as an export nation. Because right now the whole U.S. industry has been shut down. It has to be revived. And at the same time, also with this, a revival of the U.S. space program, the remaining science capacity in the United States. And on this basis, then the door is opened also for the United States to reach out in a direct collaboration with China, with India, with Russia. If these four giants go together, then you can force through a new global financial system. These nations, if they go together, they can set the terms and say, now we have a new financial system. It's still based on like these lines you see on the map, global infrastructure development, railroads, modern, all the development of the most modern technologies, make this accessible to the whole world. And this will be the basis of how we get out of the global financial crisis at present. Now, this was actually an introduction. just to give you a brief overview of the background of the election of 2008 in the United States. Because the United States population has over the last years were becoming increasingly frustrated with the Bush administration, and it became clear that the Bush administration could not solve the problems of the United States and the world. And the Bush administration, especially with the bailouts in the end of the Bush administrations, were setting the banks above the people, were bailing out the banks and the speculator, and were letting the people become destroyed, letting the U.S. economy become destroyed. And on that basis, the population of the United States rose up and spoke with a very loud voice and says, we want change. We want a new policy. The idea that was not so outspoken from most, but which was in the back of the head, was we want a change like with Franklin D. Roosevelt. At that time, we went to the dogs, we made all the stupid mistakes we could make, but then we got in a leader who wanted to change things, and who changed the policy, and who gave us a future. That was the expectation from the U.S. population in the election of 2008. And that expectation was manipulated with malice and fraud by certain forces, by circles in London, but also, of course, with their tentacles and extensions in the United States and around the world, who says, no, we don't want that kind of change from the United States. Even a person like Hillary Clinton might go with this kind of program. Therefore, we cannot have Hillary Clinton for president of the United States. Therefore, we have to take somebody that we can control, who is not of the people, who is controlled by our money, and we'll make him president of the United States. And that was Barack Obama. He was, through media control, through the money pushed in, through people like George Soros, the hedge funds, the whole cabal, he was made president of the United States. Now, of course, the population in America didn't see this at once. They said, okay, he's black, you know. He says, yes, we can. We can change. Let's see it done now. And of course, they and the rest of the world became terribly disappointed. Even very quickly, it turned out that instead of reversing the policies of the Bush administration, he not only continued them, he actually made it worse. The bailouts that Bush has made has now been extended to an amount which is enormous. I mean, it's estimated that the United States, through direct interventions, through buy-ups, through giving loans to financial entities, has been pushing in somewhere between $11,000 and $12,000 billion. $11 to $12 trillion, which is an enormous amount. I mean, it's you could build the whole world for that almost. But it's not being done to build the world, it's being done to bail out banks and speculators. At the same time as that was done, what did the American people see? They saw that they lost their homes, they lost their jobs, they lost their future, they could no longer give their kids an education at college because it could no longer be paid for. 49 out of 50 states in the United States is actually bankrupt right now. They all fire nurses, firemen, policemen, let the prisoners out of the prison because they cannot afford to keep them in anymore. So you see a dissolution of the United States. And at the same time, what did Obama do with the hated wars in Iraq and Afghanistan? He expanded them. So, and to make things even worse, this so-called unitary executive that Bush began on saying, I'm the president and therefore I'm above the law. Obama held on to that and says, yes, I'm above the law. I'm the president. I'm the Führer of this country, so don't come and mess with me. Do as I tell you. The Congress is just there to pass what I give to them. So, What we have seen under Obama is what is becoming a conscious, total destruction of the United States led by the president and his team. And that's what the revolt in the United States is all about. I mean, and this has become worse and worse by the hour. Most of you have heard about the healthcare reform. Most places, of course, it's fraudulently represented as trying to do something for the poor that don't have healthcare insurance. They will be included, but they won't have a norm. It's not like the Danish system where everybody will get healthcare. No. 44 million extra will be included in the system, and the expenditure by the state has to be reduced by one third. How is that done? By reducing the services provided. Well, wasn't there something about American insurance companies making a profit on healthcare? Yeah, they are. Will that be stopped? No. Everybody has to be forced by law to join in and pay to these private health insurance scams. So, what is then the result of this healthcare reform? Basically, that the kind of care provided to those Americans that do get health care, which is not everybody, not the 44 million that don't have it, but the rest have been gotten the best, basically the best health care you can get anywhere on the planet in the United States. And that has to be destroyed. That's the point. You have to sit down and make categories of who are to be saved and who are not to be saved. Exactly like it was done under Nazi Germany. And that Mr. LaRouche has been pointing out from the beginning. It might not for people look that way, but that's the policy. There's lives not worthy to be lived, and they have to be culled. If people get a certain age, don't save them. If it costs too much to save a person's life, don't save it. You know, we have to think economics first and people afterwards. To save money. And why do we have to save money? Because we still spend these enormous amounts on saving the banks and Wall Street. This the American people are seeing now. That's the revolt going on in the United States. And the financial looting goes on. I mean, and destruction of the United States. Obama just came out with a program saying we have to basically to dissolve NASA. The idea of the United States returning to the moon, having a program for going to Mars, has to be scrapped. We can't afford these kind of things anymore. They're going to destroy it. No science capacity in the United States then. And what about rebuilding the U.S. economy? Well, the Obama administration has been very explicit that the Army Corps of Engineers that are being used for development of the American infrastructure, like water projects, like dams, like flood control. This is all done by the U.S. Military Corps of Engineers. That will be, the funding for that will be cut to half. Why? Because we don't want to waste money on that. But so it's the direct opposite. Take everything Roosevelt did, and the Obama administration is doing the opposite. So, LaRouche has been the one saying it most explicitly. What we are seeing is that Barack Obama and administration, under British orders, is destroying the United States. It's that simple. Making sure that the United States will never again stand on its own feet as a superpower in the world, committed to scientific and technological development, committed to having sovereign nation states around the world, the United States will be crushed once and for all. And once the United States is gone, nobody else will be around to challenge the supremacy of private financial interests in the world. So seemingly this is all going according to schedule. Not our schedule, but the City of London schedule. But you also see that there are a revolt going on in the United States to stop this. This is Washington in August 2009. When there began what you can call a mass strike process in the United States, a revolt by the people. not under the control of the Democratic Party, not under control of the Republican Party, not under control of any of the established institutions, but basically being normal people of all kinds of life, standing up and saying, no, we've got enough, we will not take this any longer, especially on the healthcare issue at that time. This poster we made with Obama, you can see it to the left with the Hitler mustache, became a very popular poster because this is Hitler healthcare. We don't want it. Shave that mustache off, Mr. President. And at this time, the protest took the nature of people going to meeting with their congressmen coming home for summer vacation and demanding of their congressmen that they stand up to Obama on the healthcare issue. That the congressmen represent the people, that the congressmen take a fight with Wall Street. That the congressmen make sure we don't stop the bailouts. That the people come first. Now, this has not stopped. This is ongoing. This is growing day by day. But for some time, people have nowhere to go. So it's not like you've seen big demonstrations. It's like they're meeting in different places. They're getting pissed. And again, not based on the, it's what you also have seen these report on these what they call the Boston Tea Party, the Tea Parties, in reference to the Boston Tea Party of patriotic groupings coming together and say, we are not Republicans, we are not Democrats, but we are American, and we will no longer sit by and see our nation being destroyed. And then they have all funny ideas about how that should be done. They don't have a concrete program. We have that, we provide that, we intervene into this with this program, saying the LaRouche plan, this is how we can get out of this. And in January, you had another show of this with the election in Massachusetts, where Senator Ted Kennedy died, and they had to have a new senator in Massachusetts, in a district the Democrats have held for their own for 60 years. And where no Republican could ever win. And because of this outrage, because Obama supported the Democratic candidate, the Republican opponent, Scott Brown, won. Now, that was the small thing. Then came the big earthquake, taking place here on March 2nd, where one of our people, Keisha Rogers, a LaRouche organizer from the LaRouche Youth Movement, one of the leaders of the LaRouche Youth Movement, ran a campaign in Texas, in the 22nd district, which includes NASA, the NASA area, on the specific theme, save NASA, impeach Obama, vote Keisha Rogers. And based on this slogan, based on going out door to door, knocking on the doors of people, despite the fact that she ran against a candidate, two other candidates, one Doug Blatt had the support of the Texas Democratic Party. He was getting the money, he was getting the support. He was supposed to be a shoo-in. But when election day came around, Keisha got 53% of the votes. So she got more votes than the two other candidates together and won the race arms down. In the Democratic Party, in Barack Obama's own party, with the main point, impeach the president. I mean, it's almost unthinkable. How can people from the how can the Democratic voters that should be so proud of having the presidency with President Obama, this great hero out there, you know, that all of the Europeans praise as being so great, and the Democratic voter says, no, he's a traitor, he should be impeached. Better now than tomorrow. So that's quite a shock, because it's a sign of the times to come. It's what LaRouche calls his webcast. Beware the Ides of March. Remember Julius Caesar? He wanted to be king. What became of him? His friends got rid of him. So the people have a very strong sentiment that they've been betrayed by Obama. But it's not just Obama. They feel totally betrayed by the Congress. The congressmen they visited in August 2009 to talk with, they won't even talk to now. If they do anything, they come with the rope and lynch them. Because they've been so betrayed. The nation is falling apart, and nothing is done. So it's under these circumstances, LaRouche says, it's very simple. For the world to survive right now, for the United States to survive as a nation, Obama has to leave as president. Because he's not capable of changing. We have proposed changes. Everything that's been done is simply changing the policy for the worse and for the direct destruction of the United States. Therefore, he has to leave the presidency. But how is that possible? People will say. Can the president just leave? Can you impeach the president? Is this not a long procedure? And the answer is no. Once the decision is made that the president can no longer be the president because the nation's future is at stake, things move very quickly. Richard Nixon was never impeached. He was told that if he did not leave office, he would be impeached. And then he packed his bags and left. That's what LaRouche says has to happen in the United States. And more circles, I mean, on the one side you have the population being in uproar and revolt about this. At the same time, you have more and more of the leading institutions in Washington, in the presidency, in the military, in former military service, in former intelligence service, which comes to an agreement, yes, LaRouche is right. Obama has to leave because he's a traitor to the nation. And this, and of course, it's not only the United States. LaRouche has been using the most recent example is, look what is happening in Haiti. Haiti was not destroyed by an earthquake. You had an earthquake which exposed what everybody knew, really, that Haiti is simply a place to die. There's no infrastructure, there's no capacity of providing for the population down there, and with the earthquake, it simply meant that the little that there was destroyed in Port-au-Prince and other places. Now comes the rainy season. Now comes the point where if people stay in Port-au-Prince, they're going to die from all kinds of diseases since they have no toilet, you have no sanitation, you have no sewer system, and the whole thing gets, you have a lot of people, and then you get the floods coming in. It simply means that you're going to get a nightmare of disease. Who can do something to deal with this? There's only one that seriously can do it, and that's the United States and the U.S. military. Send in the Corps of Engineers, build new camps for people, move them out of the low areas, make sure that they survive. Clinton and others are working on this. What does Obama say? No. The earthquake is over. We went in there with some aid. Now we've done ours. Now we pull out and leave it to the government of Haiti to deal with the situation. What will it mean? It'll mean mass death. It's that simple. Probably also diseases which will then spread to many other countries and stuff. But that's the policy. The United States under Obama feels no responsibility for doing any good in the world anymore. If Obama goes, it opens suddenly up the bag for doing all of these things. Going in with real economic development, getting the four powers agreement, getting a future. And Asia is ready. I mean, what we've seen in the last couple of months, which kind of was highlighted with this COP15 meeting here in Copenhagen, where, as most of you know, we were very active, we were out there, we were distributing thousands and thousands of leaflets to the delegates, basically say, don't do it. This is a setup. The green policy is basically a blueprint for genocide. The idea of this whole idea of the man-made carbon lies is to create the illusion that we are too many people in the world, and therefore, and we have to reduce development, and when we reduce development, what do we get? We have to reduce the number of people living. That's the agenda of the British and Prince Philip's. Openly said with the World Wildlife Foundation that there should only be 2 billion people in the world. If we're 6.7 now, it means 4.7 have to go. Plus babies and what else would come. And at the COP15 meeting, you actually had China and India saying, no, we won't go along with this. We won't sign on to the deal. We won't sign on to new colonialism in the name of green policy. We say no to this. That at the same time that this was going on, you have a process which here is signified by this, by the red countries and the green countries. By the red countries saying, we go for nuclear power, we go for scientific development. The green countries, the European Union saying, no, green policy. No nuclear power, even though France and others have nuclear power, but as a bloc, no, that's not the way to go. And then you see in South and Central America, under the impression of the drug mafia taking control over the nations, also having an anti-development policy. And the big question being, what will the United States, what will the other nations, but also, of course, the green nations, will they get sane and go with nuclear power and development like the core Asian countries are doing right now? And I mean, and this has been going on, if you watch the news wires, this is like every week there's new news. Then it's China and Russia deciding, we'll spend some of our currency reserves on developing infrastructure in Russia. Let's build Chinese high-speed trains in Russia. Russia then on as a counter offer, getting in on helping China to develop their nuclear power capacity, building nuclear power plants in China. Then you have South Korea moving in very aggressively and saying that nuclear power exports is going to be bigger in the future than our shipping export today. The huge shipbuilding capacity they have, well, this was one leg, but nuclear power exports will be just as important in the future. So they are doing this. They had to the United Arab Emirates. They just have a deal, I think, of 6 nuclear power plants. They're beginning setting up all kinds of agreements. Also academies to develop nuclear engineers and so on and so forth. At the same time, you then have Russia and India agreeing to Russia coming in and building a series of nuclear power plants in India. And what for most people is a real shocker, China and India now beginning to directly collaborate with one another, beginning directly setting up very much, much closer trade links, something most people would think was unthinkable, because China and India, I mean, this is one of the games, play the two against each other. But they are right now beginning to unite. So you see a getting together in Asia on this kind of economic development, of vision for the future. And then, of course, the big issue being, will the United States join in them? If the United States join them, then everybody else will be in a rush to get in on it before it's too late. If the United States has as its sole mission to destroy this, then unfortunately there's a lot of power to sabotage and destroy this. Just to repeat, where's Europe in all of this? And that's a big problem. Europe is not there. Europe is green. Europe is right now totally within the pockets of private financial interests. They're under the control of what we have called the present extended British Empire, not just control from the British Isles, but this global slime mold of banks and financial interests sitting and controlling things and pulling the strings and manipulating things behind the scenes. And if you want to put a closer name on it right now. What we have right now is this British Extended Empire. It's what is called the Inter-Alpha Group of banks, which was a group of banks set up in 1971 at the same time that Nixon took the dollar off the gold, destroyed the Bretton Woods system as it had existed. The Inter-Alpha Group of banks was created first, consisting of six banks within the European, not Union at the time, the European Community at the time. Now it's 11 banks today, a long row of banks, banks like Bango, the Royal Bank of Scotland Group, which is also where you have this guy to the right here, Lord Jacob Rothschild. He's a key controller of that group. Here you see him together with Warren Buffett and Arnold Schwarzenegger at a historic event at his castle when Buffett came in with Schwarzenegger to present him for approval of becoming the new governor of California, and hopefully they thought at the time maybe even the new president of the United States at some point. That's how they work. You select people, they bring them in. The banker says, we can use you. And then you get the bank begging, and then you suddenly become get the very high posts. Now, this Inter-Alpha Group of banks, it's the Royal Bank of Scotland Group, Banco Santander from Spain, a very key player in this whole thing, a very key controller also of the policy of Brazil. I'll get back to that. Societe Generale from France, Commerzbank in Germany, the AIB Group in Ireland, Banco Espírito Santo SA in Portugal, the ING Bank in the Netherlands, Intesa San Paolo, KBC Bank in Belgium, National Bank of Greece, and here in Scandinavia it's Nordea, which is then representing Denmark, Finland and Sweden. Now, the policy behind this Inter-Alpha Group of banks is very concretely to make sure to do away from 1971 on it. The project was do away with national sovereignty, especially also in the European Community and, as we know today, the European Union. Away with national sovereignty. Governments should be made impotent. Private financial interests will rule supreme. And this is the policy we've seen bit by bit with the in the European Community, with the inner market, with the free movement of capital and goods. And we saw it then with the extension of the development of the euro, very explicit, to do away with national sovereignty, most emphatically the German Deutschmark, but also all other nations' ability to control their own economy. And then, as in the last phase here, the Lisbon Treaty, basically to make sure that the European law will reign, European Union law reign supreme over national law. No longer sovereign and sovereignty. Who controls the European Union policy? Private financial interests. The banks, the bankers, the speculators, these private financial circles. And as we are in a crisis which day by day gets deeper, also here in the European Union. I mean, we've seen what people call the Greece crisis, with Greece having a budget deficit of over 12%. But it's not a crisis for Greece. Then people even acknowledge, no, it's the PIGS. It's also Portugal and Ireland and Greece, Spain. Look at Spain. Spain is a much, 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 much bigger economy and bigger problem than Greece. And what is common with all these countries have in common is that they're part of the euro. They're part of the eurozone. Normally, if a country has problem, then its currency will get into trouble. The currency will be devalued, and somehow, you know, the country has to deal with these things. Being part of the euro, you cannot devalue your currency. What can you do then? Well, says the European Union and the bankers, there's only one thing to do. Austerity, austerity, austerity. You can cut the budget. You can fire all the public employees. You can take away all the pensions. You can raise the taxes to the sky. The problem is, can you really do that? Can you enforce that kind of austerity in Greece right now? Can you get people to voluntarily give up their life and well-being and future? And the answer is no. There's no way you can do that. How can you then do it? You have to do it under the bayonets. Then you need somebody to enforce the policy. And it will not be with good words. Then you have somebody to enforce the policy under the gun. This is what we saw in the 30s. I mean, this is not new. I mean, we've been there before. This is the fight in Europe right now. If you want to try, if you want to save, and you have to remember what has been going on here. All of the losses by the banks, by the speculators, are supposed to be taken over by the governments. As the government, and Iceland being the most extreme example, with ICE, with an Icelandic bank going bust, then it's being said, no, the Icelandic nation has to pay this. If the Icelandic nation has to pay this, who has to pay it? The Icelandic people. Who's going to enforce it? The world community is going to make sure that nobody gets away from taking responsibility for this. You sacrifice the general welfare, you sacrifice the population in order to save the system. And right now, I mean, there's all funny games going on in Europe right now. The new game is called the European Monetary Fund. This is especially the German government is pushing for this. That you should have, like you have the International Monetary Fund as a global policeman coming in telling the countries what to do. You'll have a European Monetary Fund where people then can get loans, but the idea is not to give them loans. The idea is to have a policeman to tell them how to cut their budgets. Will it work? Will it save things? No. It is way, way too big. And a much bigger thing is coming into play now, because what is this people like the Inter-Alpha group of banks doing? How are they making money? Well, they take the money they borrow from the European Central Bank at 1%, and then they invest the money in Brazil. There they can get 10% on Brazilian state bonds. But not only that, last year the real also increased its value, so they actually got a total profit for 37% on the money invested. Who can say no to that? You borrow at 1%, invest in Brazil, you get 37%. This is as good as the Russian GKO state bonds were at one point. And what happened to the Russian GKO state bonds? Well, at some point, Russia went bankrupt on it. What will happen on this? The Brazilian bubble will burst. And all of these banks, which now record record profits on lending out to the bubble in Brazil, having huge profits on paper, will suddenly be bankrupt. So this carry trade we see now of lending money one place very cheaply, lending it out to a higher price, sure profit, like it was with the investment in the Russian state funds at that in earlier times, it will end one place, the bubble will burst, and that's the end of it. Now, just one footnote on this, because Lula is being used, Brazil is being used very, very actively by the British. He's being used, most emphatically controlled by Banco Santander, who has huge operations in Brazil. The name of the game is build the Brazil bubble, see how great it is, convince the Russians that Brazil is a viable replacement for the United States as a partner in the Four Powers Agreement, And instead of having a four powers agreement between the United States, Russia, India, and China, have the BRIC. Brazil, Russia, India, China. It's all based on the premise that there is something in Brazil that's the bubble that is, has been built up. And that, that Lula, in this sense, is... I don't know how conscious he himself is in this, but, you know, if somebody provides the money and you're living off somebody else's money, they have you by the balls. They tend to be able to determine what policy you make when push comes to shove. So this is, again, just one more on this British game, divide and conquer, divide and rule. Make sure that the United States and Russia right now don't go together to solve this crisis, because if these four big players go together and then everybody else groups around that, then private financial interest is out of the window. And if that is done, a lot of other problems can be solved. We see it in the Middle East. Still today, we see the remnants of this British set-up Sykes-Picot agreement, where you have made all kinds of deals to one and the other, promises, the British always supports everybody, and then you get people to go to war against each other, and the British stand on the side and pick up the pieces as it's fallen apart. And as I said in the opening, you see it right now with this setting that has been going on for some time of this not only Israeli attack on Iran, but also to make sure that Iran and maybe others then return the attack in order to get a full religious and general warfare going on. You see all these games. I mean, you saw this whole Dubai incident, you know, where the Mossad comes in and liquidates a Hamas leader and so on. That's not really something new. They've been doing a lot of that. But why do they do it for open camera? And what is Dubai anyway? Dubai is totally British controlled. Dubai is totally drug money. It's totally controlled by these financial circles. So putting out on the world television set how the Israelis is going around killing Arab leaders, this is just like the genocide committed against the Palestinians on the West Bank, a very good way to incite people to get the juices going for the coming war. And that's how the British play these things. So LaRouche has been very emphatically in what he thinks has to be the agenda. Destroy the Interalpha Group. Destroy this British control. Impeach Obama. This has to happen. We don't know all the details of how it's going to happen, but we know it has to happen if we are to get a way out of this mess. We need a global Glass-Steagall shutting down all of these speculative bubbles. And we have to have this four-power agreement together with a global credit system, a mechanism to create national credit for big infrastructure projects and developments. In such a way that all nations can have a development, that we get a world order which finally becomes a collaboration between sovereign nation states, where we, through economic development, through that kind of LaRouche plan to solve the crisis, avoid getting what would otherwise be right now, very concretely, a rerun in a lot worse form of what we saw in the 30s in Europe. So we need the American system. We need the live, like we had, there was a way out with the Franklin D. Roosevelt plan. Then we do have very concretely on the table and in the discussion, I want to say, in the United States, the LaRouche option now. We can use human creativity through science and technology to make sure that with such a world order and states committed to the general welfare, we don't have to reduce the world population from 6.7 billion to 2, but we can be 10 or 20 or how many people we might choose to be with an excellent standard of living and all being engaged in spending our talents for the future of humanity. But it means that we have, the nations of the world has to be smart. They have to unite against this this British divide and conquer, divide and rule strategy. And on the most hesitant point, I will say, namely, yes, but will it be possible to get the United States to change side in this and return to its roots? Then we saw it with Kishia's victory, that this as a sign, as a very potent sign that yes, this is possible. And it's not only possible, it is in the makings in the United States right now. So with that, I think I should have raised enough topics and issues to to have a general discussion. So I think we'll go over to that. Michelle asked, should we have a break now or should we?
I'll make a quick phone call. But you can
yes.
But we're going to have a break anyway.
It all depends also on